Good evening. Great. Well, that's first thing sorted out. Welcome to the Martin Amis public event on literature and Britishness. I'm Mara Pittock, and I'm going to be introducing the event. I'm going to speak for a few minutes in introducing the topic and both our speakers. Then they're each going to speak for about 6 or 7 minutes. Then there'll be a debate on the platform, and then the floor will be open for questions. So that's the running of events, and there'll be a signing afterwards, which I'll refer to again towards the end downstairs. Well, literature and Britishness, what a vexed topic. In 1982, Blake Morrison and Andrew Motion brought out the contemporary book, Penguin Contemporary Book of British Poetry. It contained 6 Irish authors. Of those, Irish authors comprised almost a third of the length of the book, and they were all, it is true, born or raised in the north of Ireland. However, since the north of Ireland, Northern Ireland, is not actually a part of Britain, but is part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, it was technically inaccurate to include them. Moreover, the collection was headed, and he objected to this, by Seamus Heaney, who was represented by poems including Anna Chorish, which problematized, in terms of language, the whole notion, and indeed in terms of politics, the whole notion of Britishness itself. To cap this problem, if you like, 4 of these 6 poets had previously appeared in the Penguin Book of Irish Verse. So simultaneously, Penguin had published them under 2 nationalities. An interesting question, and maybe our first problem. Our second, to move on to the novel, in 1994, James Kelman won, to extreme excoriation, really, in many quarters, won the Booker Prize for How Late It Was, How Late. One of the judges, Rabbi Julia Neuberger, described the decision eloquently as crap. Simon Jenkins decided that he would expatiate at length on the fact that it was literary vandalism, and a number of other journalists and commentators described reading Kelman's prose as being attacked by a drunken Glaswegian in a pub. No one saw the author of The Bus Conductor Hines as redefining Dubliners and the world of Dubliners for a new city and a new generation. Instead, the issue of language and what constitutes acceptable language was very much to the fore. And this leads into the whole question of what is Britishness and how it's represented in its art and literature. And I think, although we could spend all evening on that, we're going to spend a good time on it, I think that we could say that since the Labour government came to power in 1997, there have been at least 3 distinct phases. There was, first of all, the Cool Britannia phase, Britpop, Britart, cutting-edge Britishness. You might have thought that was the compelling argument, but no. Within 3 or 4 years, we moved into another phase about multicultural Britain, inclusive, re-internationalizing Britain, not on the old terms of the British Empire, but in the new terms of a multicultural Britain. And then that, we would have thought, was quite modern too. But 3 or 4 years later, we moved to yet a third phase, which is the phase that has just been forgotten about in the credit crunch, the phase of flags in the garden, oaths of allegiance, a Britain Day, rather like the Empire Day of the 1930s. And if Britpop and Britart were succeeded by the world of Zadie Smith's White Teeth, the third phase of Britishness became much like Rudyard Kipling. And that is one of the very difficulty of settling on how the government itself can promote and recognize Britishness, and how Britishness can be expressed in the art and culture of this island, is at the absolute core of the kind of controversy that is liable to be roused tonight. And to help rouse or put to rest that controversy, we have, of course, our 2 distinguished speakers. Martin Amis, who, of course, is Professor of Creative Writing at this university, and has done so much in the last 30 years to grapple with the issues of contemporary life that we experience, and even also the issues we don't experience, but perhaps just as significant to contemporary life, we fear. His 20th or 21st novel, Pregnant Widow, is coming out this autumn. We also have Hard Jacobson, who has for many years written about the nature in a comedic, and I think they're both authors have got a strong streak of that, in a comedic frame, has written about the Jewish experience in Britain. He's written 10 novels and, of course, has got a very strong media presence. Many of his works, including Seriously Funny, have been adapted for television. And his latest novel is The Act of Love, which was published in 2008. Well, without more ado, I shall ask our speakers to make their initial statements about literature and Britishness. Martin Amis.
Good evening. Can you all hear me? And I'd like to thank you, I've been meaning to do this for a while, for the terrific support you've given these events. You've been a marvelous audience and an intrepid one, too, coming out on some very vile nights. You see before you at this table the two last comic British novelists. Now, why is that? Because it's almost true, I'd say. Nietzsche defined a joke as an epigram on the death of a feeling. I think that's a brilliant description of a sick joke. I remember a very tough guy I used to know who was tremendously upset when Princess Diana got killed, although he was a rough guy. Very funny, bright guy. And he joined in the sort of millennial sorrow, the weird, irrational millennial sorrow for Princess Diana. And then about 2 weeks later, he came up to me and said, Princess Di was on the radio last night, and on the windscreen, and on the speedometer. And he added, I knew it was all over then. He said, the minute I heard that. That's an epigram on the death of a feeling. I would say, more generally, a joke is a more or less ironic claim to superiority or an underlining of difference. And that is what our culture, as it now stands, has tremendous unease about, with some good reasons, some more reflexive reasons. For instance, not many people will regale you with, an Irishman, an Englishman and a Welshman went into that kind of joke. Philip Roth in Portnoy's Complaint said, here's a Jewish joke for you. Three Jews are walking down Fifth Avenue in New York, my father, my mother, and me. And then goes on to tell an embarrassing anecdote about Jewish fearfulness and other things. How do you get an Irishman, stroke Pole, stroke Afrikaner, to burn his face, ring him up while he's doing the ironing? Now, I can tell there's a sort of growing unease, but we can't talk about collectivities of people anymore. Our culture won't allow it. And we should perhaps remember what the professor of jurisprudence, Ronald Dworkin, said recently, that he said, in fact, no one has the right never to be offended. Very important principle, but he says our whole system is reliant on freedom of speech, and once that is eroded, our system begins to wobble. But let's think, let's sort of tiptoe into it. Orwell said the English, I think more than the British, are exceptionally fond of flowers. Now, I'm sure no one has a problem with that. Nor perhaps when Lawrence, in one of his travel books, says that Germans are very cheerful in the morning, Swiss people are very cheerful in the morning, Italians are dead in the morning. We tiptoe on. My father once in print said he was trying to find a connection between cuisines and people. And he went through it in his mind. He said, England, Britain, nice people, nasty food. France, nice food, nasty people. Spain, nice people, nasty food. Italy, nice people, nice food. Germany, nasty food, nasty people. And someone, when he published this, someone wrote in to the Times and said, it seems as if Mr. Amis has something against Germans per se. And his reply began, yeah, that's right. And we perhaps wonder, you know, when is it legitimate to have a grudge against a people? I mean, two world wars plus the Holocaust, all made in Berlin. It would be extremely unnatural not to have certain feelings about that. We also may note, as Howard was writing about this the other week, that it is obviously very offensive, as Prince Harry found out, to refer to Pakis. On the other hand, or as well, no Australian minds being called an Aussie. It's a marginal case in South America, where I spent 3 years, whether the Argentinians mind being called Argies. I found that they didn't. And by the way, in South America, the Argies are the Germans of that continent, widely regarded as such. So is it to do with confidence of a people, or is it to do with how much discrimination they've faced? Perhaps this will come up again. Britishness. People are like countries, and countries are like people. But the people that countries are like are unusually touchy and obsessive, and obsessed by privilege and face and legitimacy to an abnormal degree. If we look at Great Britain and imagine it as a person with a life history, we had a very troglodytic childhood and early youth. You know, while great civilizations rose and fell elsewhere in India, China, in the Islamic world, very advanced societies, we were still cave dwellers. But then once we got going, and with our princely state, our kingly state, our state nation, our nation state, our market state as it is now, we were quite far ahead. And I think only of the great powers, only Holland got things done as quickly as England did. We had our revolution and civil war a century before the French. and now we're very evolved and we lead the world in decline. We're much better at that than anyone else. and we've become, Great Britain is now a sort of a heavy drinker, very obsessed with surfaces and superficialities, in my view. Is one proud of being British? Very dangerous feeling, that. And if I were to say whether I was or not, I'd say I'm proud to be of the nation of Shakespeare. And I'm proud of the fact that, you know, it's often said of Russian literature that, you know, George Steiner would say that their literature is drenched in blood, and, you know, that's why it's so powerful. But as E.M. Foster said, Britain may fear the novels of other countries, Russia, France, certainly America now, but British poetry fears no man. And I think that is, to have that polity, an evolved polity, and that poetry, I think is something to be proud of. If I were to define Britishness in a literary sense, I would talk about the line of sanity that is so strong in British writing. And the comic novel is a reflection of the confidence of that sanity and rationality, because as Clive James once said, I'm not sure if he was plagiarizing anyone, but he said, comedy is just common sense dancing. And if the common sense is strong, then the comedy will be strong. And to finish up where we began, you know, why has the comic novel slipped away? And it certainly has. The novel began in England, in Britain, as a comic novel with Sterne and Smollett. The line of sanity appears not quite late on. Fielding even is a bit sort of up and down with Jane Austen, the most penetratingly sane writer we have, along with George Eliot. And I would just cite three words of her. They're her last words. Dying at the age of 44 of untreatable, of course, and unalleviable cancer, she was asked what she needed, and she said, nothing but death. The strength of that sanity, I think the greatest last words ever. But the comic novel is winding down, and why is this? It's partly cultural, and it's partly a culture of, you know, taking offense and being on red alert to take offense. That's all true. But there must be other historical reasons for it. And if I were to, you know, why can't we take a joke anymore? And if I were to give the answer, it's it would be because of changes in the self. And there's a certain sense of fragility that we all have. And a wild guess is that it's to do with the acceleration of history that we're all kind of aware of. History has speeded up, and the future has never looked more remorselessly, you know, unforeseeable. Thank you.
And now, is my voice reaching you all right? May I say it's very good to be here. I am a Manchester boy. I don't say that to win your sympathy. Well, I do say that to win your sympathy, but there's something a bit special about being here. I've never actually been here. I've walked through this building, the university, but I've never done anything here. I've never performed here or done anything academic or anything literary here. But I am reminded of the day I got my my telegram to say I had got into Cambridge. I don't say that to boast. I just happened to get into Cambridge. As it happened, I had the most vile time in Cambridge. It was horrible when I was at Cambridge. But anyway, my mother brought me the telegram to say I'd got into Cambridge, and I said, I'm in, and she said, talking about Jewish anxiety, she said, it might be a mistake, it might be for somebody else. Don't get disappointed, you could still always go to Manchester University. So here I am at Manchester University. I've got pages and pages of notes because I couldn't really work out where this subject would go, because it could go in so many directions. And as soon as Martin started to talk about our being the last two comic novelists, I wish we were talking about comedy instead of Britishness, but the two are quite rightly connected. I mean, I wish we were just talking about each other, actually, and why we are the last two comic novelists. Not only that, but just even before we get to why we are the last two comic novelists, what very, very good comic novelists we are. I mean, if someone was to say, you know, find three contemporary pieces of prose that really make you laugh, one of them would be Martin's, the other two would be mine, but one of them would certainly be Martin's. But I'm going to come at comedy obliquely and just try and throw a few unthought-out ideas. I've got nothing worked out about where I am on this. So just let me throw out a few thoughts. Multiculturalism has always worried me as a term. I don't believe it exists. I don't think there is such a thing as multiculturalism. Orwell's been mentioned. Orwell must always crop up when one talks about Britishness or Englishness. I'm not even actually sure that Britishness exists. When I went to Cambridge, despite my mother's fear that I couldn't, I went to study English literature. I never went to study British literature. Studying English literature also meant studying Tolstoy and Aeschylus and Flaubert, but somehow even that was English literature. They came under the aegis of English literature. I don't know whether anybody studies British literature anywhere, actually, but I've never quite understood what Britishness means. When Orwell talks about Britishness, he talks about specifically about Englishness. He says something very English, interesting about English, the English intelligentsia. He said that the English intelligentsia is the only intelligentsia anywhere in the world that hates its own culture. He wonders what that might be about. He thinks it might be a certain blimpishness in the English middle classes that's caused that to happen, that the English intelligentsia feels under such pressure in a non-intellectual country that it's taken it out on its own country by hating itself. I was taught, by the way, at Cambridge by English intellectuals who hated English culture. My first tutor at Cambridge cancelled my first tutorial with him because he said he had to drive to France to buy bread. One of the reasons that I think we might, that the word multiculturalism came along, is I think that is a way in which the intelligentsia, because it's an intelligentsia word, ordinary people don't talk about living in a multicultural society. The word has come from the intelligentsia. And I think they've invented it as a way of reconciling themselves to their own country. We cannot bear England because we cannot bear English culture. But if we can forget the English part, then we can love the culture again. I'm just going to read you a little from, this is someone trying to describe sort of Britishness in a multicultural way. It's Malcolm McLaren, who was the Sex Pistols person, the manager of the Sex Pistols. He said, this is what Britishness is. It's about singing karaoke in bars, eating Chinese noodles and Japanese sushi, drinking French wine, wearing Prada and Nike, dancing to Italian house music, listening to Cher, using an Apple Mac, holidaying in Florida and Ibiza and buying a house in Spain. Shepherd's pie and going on holiday to Hastings went out about 50 years ago, and the only people you'll see wearing a Union Jack are French movie stars or Kate Moss. I get the joke. It is true that we all live in this various world. I wear an Apple Mac. I drink French. I prefer Australian wine, but I drink French wine. I don't wear Prada and... Actually, I was going to say I don't wear Prada and Nike, but I actually do have a Nike tracksuit. If we had time, I would tell you as a comic tale about the buying of a Nike tracksuit. I don't know whether any of you own a Nike tracksuit, but to actually go into a Nike store to buy a Nike tracksuit, if you really want to think about what it's like being foreign in your own country, go into a Nike stall. Where the hell are you? What is the language that the people are speaking to you in? They don't speak your own language, and they ask you questions that bear no relation to anything that you can give an answer to or about your body, and you come out buying horrible silk things that you don't. But I'm of an age where I have to go to a gym to live, and so I have to have a Nike. In fact, what I do in my Nike tracksuit, just as this has got nothing to do with anything, but I'll just let you into this. What I do in my Nike tracksuit, I've got this lovely gym where they serve ambient water, which is not too cold, but just the right temperature, and they have all the morning newspapers. So I put on my Nike tracksuit, I go into the gym, I pour myself some ambient water, I read The Independent, I read The Guardian, and then I go home. My gym, but I have walked, at least I have walked to the gym in my Nike tracksuit. That description of what it's like, of what multiculturalism in Britain is like, because we all, you know, we accept foreign food and drink foreign wine and wear foreign clothes, seems to me to say nothing about what it is to be English, what it is to use the English language or to write the English language. That's the most important part for me, well, to read Englishness and to speak the language of Shakespeare, one hopes, to have Shakespeare in one's head all the time, and to write, as best one can, the English of Shakespeare. And I thought, well, how would one get something? How would one get what that quality is? So can I just read you a little bit from Middlemarch, which seems to me to get something that for me takes us somewhere with this. This is Dorothea in Rome. Dorothea has just married Casaubon. Dorothea is a narrow, she comes from rural England. She is narrowly brought up. She comes from an almost Calvinistical background. She is extremely virginal, and she has married this dried up scholar, and he has taken her to Rome. So in a way, this is a passage about, it offers to be a passage about art, but it's also a passage about sex. Sex and the British, I hope we're going to talk about at some point. So sex and the British is underlying all this too. I'll try and read it as quickly as I can. She goes to Rome on her honeymoon, and he remains in his room working, reading, and she's allowed to just go out and look at the art of Rome. The weight of unintelligible Rome might lie easily on bright nymphs to whom it formed a background for the brilliant picnic of Anglo-foreign society, but Dorothea had no such defense against deep impressions. Ruins and basilicas, palaces and colossi, set in the midst of a sordid present, where all that was living and warm-blooded seemed sunk in the deep degeneracy of a superstition divorced from reverence. All this vast wreck of ambitious ideals, sensuous and spiritual, mixed confusedly with the signs of breathing forgetfulness and degradation, at first jarred her as with an electric shock. Dorothea, all her life, continued to see the vastness of St. Peter's, the huge bronze canopy, the excited intention in the attitudes and garments of the prophets and evangelists in the mosaics above, and the red drapery which was being hung for Christmas, spreading itself everywhere like a disease of the retina. I think that's one of the truly great pieces of writing in English to write like that, to have rendered the wonderful turbulence of aesthetic excitement, seeing art that you don't recognize, seeing art that you challenge, seeing foreignness. It's about an English mind, the English mind of a young virginal English woman dealing with something foreign, never mind what the nature of the foreignness is, and it renders wonderfully what the excitement is, and it gives everything to what's out there in Rome that's not in England. But what I love about it is something that I think is quintessentially English in the voice. The weight of unintelligible Rome might lie easily on bright nymphs to whom it formed. That's slightly distant, slightly sardonic. It could be from Dr. Johnson, it could be from Rasselas. If I was doing a course on Englishness in literature, one of the key books for me would be Dr. Johnson's Rasselas, in which we have, I think, the English intelligence at its greatest, and the English intelligence that influenced Jane Austen profoundly, and George Eliot too through Jane Austen, and us still. It's in its satiric, all-comprehensive, tolerant, ironic voice, proud of what it is itself, proud of its own insularity and aloofness, while at the same time knowing how absurd that is, highly intelligent, distant, and I'm talking too much now, but that's where I would go first for my sense of what Englishness is.
Can I just interpose, sure, to follow up on what Howard said? Dorothea is about to be, it's the only bit of the novel that isn't of this middle, the median, the middle march. It's the only bit of sort of generic slippage in the novel where Will Ladislaw is the one she really fancies, not this terrible old guy who's writing a book called The Key to All Mythologies and getting absolutely nowhere with it. And she's asked around, Will Ladislaw is in Rome, and she's asked about what she thinks of the paintings, and she says, they frighten me. Now, this is the very early recognition of sex in the English novel. I mean, there's plenty of sex in Fielding and so on, but once it tightened up, then there's not much in the 19th century that's as overtly sexual as that. I was saying to Howard beforehand, Pride and Prejudice is the sexiest of Jane Austen's novels. Not much overlooked this, I think. Just before the end, and anyone who's reading it with a sort of romantic feeling of wanting Elizabeth and Darcy to get together, which we all do because we know that they're made for each other. That's the beauty of the book. Elizabeth's father takes her aside and says, 10 pages from the end, you know, you're aghast. He says, don't marry him. And he says to her, I know your nature, Lizzie. In a loveless marriage, she doesn't believe she loves him. In a loveless marriage, you could be neither happy nor respectable. Discredit and misery would await you in a loveless marriage. Now, what does that mean? Her nature would go elsewhere. She would become an adulterer and a fallen woman. I mean, then we may think back to that early scene where she goes to visit Jane, her sister, at Bingley's place, and comes scandalously alone over miles of wet countryside and appears with flashing teeth and bright eyes, and her petticoat stained 6 inches in mud. Let me think of how Dickens does it. In Hard Times, Louisa Gradgrind is about to marry this lousy old crook called Bounderby, an old man again, as in Middlemarch with Dorothea. And they're looking out over Coketown, and there are these chimneys. And she says, she comes in to express unease about her marriage to her father, the utilitarian Gradgrind. And she says, "See those chimneys out there, father?" He says, "Yes." And she says, "At night, flame comes out of the top of them." And Gradgrind says, "I do not see the relevance of that remark, Louisa." And we may even wonder whether Dickens saw the relevance of it. But the Britishness and sex is something I hope we can return to.
Can I just say something? I mean, I've just written a novel that's about sex, and it was received fine, but I also had the feeling it was received largely with complete incomprehension, because it was a book that was not meant to be a sexy book. It was a book actually about eroticism, and once you bring in the word eroticism, the English have had it. They just cannot. I mean, it should be erotisme. And it doesn't even sound right. Eroticism just sounds, you know, icy for the thing that it is. But if we can't do eroticism in this country, we actually can't think philosophically about sex. I agree with Martin. I think we do sex fantastically well, particularly when we don't write about it at all, exactly in the way. The best sex in the English novel, there is no mention of sex. That bit that I just read you from Middlemarch is all about sex. The redness spreading itself like a disease. Only the English could write about, you know, what it's like to have your virginity taken away as a disease of the retina. I mean, that is fantastic. I think of a scene in, well, it's American, but it's an American still being an Englishman in the Wings of the Dove, when the hero comes in and he knows that the woman with whom he wishes to have an adulterous affair, but he hasn't yet had an adulterous affair, has been to see him in his hotel room, I think, and he wasn't there, but he knows she's been waiting for him and she's now gone, and he comes into the room and he just smells her presence there. And he just comes into the room and knows that she was there, and he falls into a sort of trance, imagining her presence in that room. And it's so sexy, so hot in the English novel when it's not mentioned at all. I wish we could talk about. Can we just talk about sex?
We will.
Take us away from sex.
Well, I was wondering whether this is about sanity, if I could say. And also about jokes, because it seems to be one of the definitions of sanity. If sanity is a value, as Martin suggested, is absolutely core to, well, you're proud to be born in the nation of Shakespeare, Shakespeare was born in the Kingdom of England, and you're proud to be represented by the novel tradition that began with Irish-born Sterne and Scottish-born Smollett. So we'll take it to under advisement whether it's English or British we're talking about tonight. One of the things I wonder about your case about sanity is whether sanity means the condition of having the right to laugh at the insane, the ridiculous, the absurd, the explicit, but doesn't have the condition of being laughed at. If you describe your, I mean, is part of your objection to jokes being objectionable today actually come from the fact that there is a tradition in English society of everybody else being a fit subject for humour, the Italians, the Germans, the Spaniards, all the rest of it, but oneself not being a fit subject for humour, and is that one of the definitions of sanity?
Well, I was thinking earlier that that our literature does seem to be grounded in sanity in a way that distinguishes it from all others I can think of. In South America, you know, we're all used to magical realism now, where, you know, you can't turn a page without there being a purple donkey levitating past your window. That's not a recent thing in South America. It's been like that since the middle of the 19th century. That the world they live in and lived in down there is so extravagant and deeply unjust, and the rhythm of all those countries was between chaos and despotism, that the imagination needed a different way to go than social realism, which was sort of barely existed. There was no realism in that continent. Look at Russia. Tolstoy, supremely sane, but quite sort of vulnerable and getting less sane. And the Kreutzer Sonata is nuts, his final novella, full of a weird hatred of sex. And by that time, Tolstoy was saying that it is disgusting and immoral to make love to a woman who's had a child. That's it. You know, once they've had one, perhaps two, then you leave them alone. And look at Gogol and Dostoevsky, and this is another fantastic country where, again, there's never been any liberty in Russia for a millennium, and that breeds perversity into the nation. France, you know, Céline, Gide, the act gratuit, all these sort of slightly sleazy ideas that get very respectable. Sartre, you know, lying about collaboration, you know, not quite a grip on reality. France itself has never dealt with the fact that it shipped out 80,000 Jews for extermination. It's never dealt with it. Spain, you know, marvelous, again, rather like South America, starting with the first novel, Don Quixote, and tremendously electric and again, not realistic. And Italy and Germany, I think, not very different. But because of our sort of evolved polity, there has been this tremendous middle-class world that was what Jane Austen said, this is what you take as your subject. Jane Austen in life was surrounded by freaks. A very close neighbor and friend used to dress up in funeral gear, calling it the black stuff, and would have sort of clearly, you know, masturbation sessions over coffins. That's not in Jane Austen. She does the median world of the middle classes. I think the strength of that tradition has perhaps hampered us when we do write about sex. And the obvious exception to this rule and to every other rule is D.H. Lawrence and the trouble everyone's had assimilating him.
I could just come in there again for a moment. I think one of the if I can just pursue the question of sanity a bit further, you talked about the French not being able to cope with their part in the Holocaust, and I'm going to introduce a Russian here because I wonder that in the, for example, The Minister and the Massacres, when Nikolai Tolstoy made that case again on the repatriation of the White Cossacks, he came across something that couldn't actually be written about. Couldn't actually be expressed in just the same way as what you're saying if the French couldn't express. And here, again, I wonder whether one of the conditions of the sanity you're describing is actually that it's repressive, that it doesn't actually have difficulty in dealing with these things because it has the wonderful ability not to acknowledge they exist.
Well, I mean, I don't think there are any huge lacunae in English history. Russia is one big lacuna. You know, Stalin in Russia now, in popularity polls, is about the same level of popularity as Jimmy Carter, who, as far as I know, didn't kill 30 million Americans. De-Cossackization, de-Kulakization, all those are not discussed in Russia, just as the Holocaust is not discussed in France, and that isn't sanity, in my opinion.
I have an advantage in being an English and a Jewish writer, and I don't know which comes first. I think the English comes first. But I have an advantage in that I've got, in a way, I'm allowed a bit to say that the Holocaust is a bit mine, and I'm kind of allowed in the way that an English writer that wasn't also a Jewish writer is not allowed, and we might discuss what this allowance means, because this allowance is probably false. But nonetheless, I have a kind of license. A Jew has a kind of license. An extra nationality or an extra ethnicity gives you a kind of, we think, gives you a kind of right, and I am licensed to to go to those plays. And it seemed to me, in a novel I wrote, the novel before my last one, a novel I wrote called Kaluki Nights, that was a novel in which I wanted to write a comedy about the Holocaust. And when people heard I was writing about a comedy about the Holocaust, they were horrified because they assumed that that would mean I was making light of the Holocaust. When they read the book, in fact, nobody complained about this at all because they realized that my comedy of the Holocaust was not making light at all. There is an assumption somewhere that when in the popular imagination, and not only in the popular imagination, that by comedy we mean making light of. And that need not be what comedy is at all. Comedy can be a method for making the very opposite to light of. We're very odd around, and it worries me a lot. We're in an area now of not being able to make jokes about all sorts of things at the moment, and it worries me because it means we are putting the brakes upon comedy because we can't, which brings us back to what you were saying earlier. It means we don't trust comedy as a vehicle for, well, for expression, never mind seriousness. And yet when you think that we all know that when we have personal tragedy or personal troubles or whatever in our life, we bring to bear whatever we can. We bring solemnity to bear and we bring comedy to bear. Often we will bring comedy to bear at the most serious moments. I remember when I first experienced death in my family and I went to my grandmother's funeral, I couldn't believe that my uncles were making jokes. We're making jokes in the black vehicle that took us to the cemetery. I thought, how could they do that? How could they do that? It was only later, I was a boy, it was only later that I understood it was a very necessary thing for them to do that. It wasn't callousness. It wasn't disregard. It wasn't the opposite to serious contemplation of the fact of death. It was a contribution to the way that we think about the fact of death. And if we know that we deploy comedy at our most, sometimes at our most grievous moments, if we know that comedy is helpful to us, how can we then not deploy it as writers or as social thinkers? What are we doing when we censor comedy? We have that phrase, political correctness. It's a cliched phrase and one doesn't want to use it, but I'm very interested in the idea of there being a correctness. The truth about comedy is that we want the opposite. We laugh. Because the laughter that pleases us most is incorrect laughter. Correct laughter doesn't please us. Correct laughter makes us ill. I think there's a novel by Milan Kundera about that, about what it was like to make jokes in communist Czechoslovakia and how the jokes weren't funny. What amuses us, what breaks us apart, what really makes us laugh is incorrectness. Once you admit that we enjoy most laughing at what we know somewhere we shouldn't laugh at, then we cannot tolerate any notion of correctness whatsoever.
But then the question arises, is it, you're talking about Jewish jokes and among Jewish community, do we actually need to have a basic level of identity to make jokes about what Martin was saying, superiority and difference? Do we need a ground base? And is the problem about making jokes in the society we have now that the disparity of lifestyles and backgrounds is such that you can never be sure that you're actually not trespassing on something somebody else holds incredibly dear and which they instantly recognize you as having no common experience with and therefore no rights to comment on? You know, do you need to have a shared community to have humor?
Well, I know we all say that, and I know we all feel that. And when I feel I've made a joke which others feel is off colour in some way or is incorrect, and they want to remind me, how do you feel, they say, if someone makes a Jewish joke? And I laugh that off by saying, well, only a Jew can make a Jewish joke. And it might be the case that you can only really make the joke well if you know the whole ground rules of your community and what makes your community absurd. And there is a particular decency about making it yourself. But I'm not happy at leaving it like that. I mean, somewhere or other, I would like to believe, ideally, and we aim at an ideal, you know, as writers and thinkers, we aim at an ideal, we have to possess an ideal, that it ought to be possible for us to make jokes about one another. It might be that we all fail at the moment, but somewhere or other, it ought to be possible. Otherwise, we're all walking on eggshells the whole time. And where does that leave a writer? Can a Jewish writer only make Jewish jokes? Can an Irish writer only make Irish jokes? James Joyce, who was not a Jew, makes some wonderful Jewish jokes in Ulysses. He found a way.
And he absolutely nails anti-Semitism in Ulysses, just as Roman Catholicism is the other villain of that book. Well, genetics has shown us that racial or national or even ethnic differences are all very tiny. We vary from each other by, you know, tiny percentage points. But we all know that that acculturation and the culture is what distinguishes us, and history and degree of political freedom. When Obama was not quite yet president, all the polls in the Middle East, with the exception of Israel, funnily enough, all very pro him. Although, you know, there's been plenty of racism in the Middle East, in the Islamic countries and in Iran, but all the numbers were up to 85. But then there was a second poll which said, do you think he'll become president? And 95% of people said they'll never let him. And what a shock that must have been to see the power of transparent democracy just asserting itself at a time when democracy was not, you know, had several reverses. I think the degree of freedom a nation has had is very defining. And it's just the sort of thing you can't talk about. you know, in my experience, talking about Britishness, I'm English, but I spent many years in Wales. And that's the one I know, my childhood in Wales. But my feeling is that I've never met an Irish person who doesn't speak very well. I think Scottish people are very good at law and philosophy, and the Irish are said to divide into two camps. The men, particularly, said, either you're a hard man or you're a desperate chancer. And my feeling is that Scotland is full of hard men, with the odd chancer. But Wales, I mean, don't tell me there isn't a Welsh identity. And here is what it is. We were driving along, my little sister, who was then four, me, my brother, you know, eight and nine. My mother was driving us, and we had our Welsh nanny in the car. And there was a terrible accident up ahead, and a blood-bespattered figure writhing under a white sheet. And I remember thinking as an eight-year-old, I hope my sister doesn't see this. And as we drove past Eva Garcia, Celt-Iberian, propped my sister up on the back seat and said, look at him, Sal, writhing in agony. when I first came across the word schadenfreude, I thought it was a Welsh word. Once I said, Eva, can I have a glass of milk with my lunch? And she almost got up, and then she sank back in her chair, and she said, no. And I said, why not? And she said, I knew a man who drank a glass of milk with his lunch, and he died. So that was fine, except for the next 30 years, I never drank a glass of milk ever again. But it's very mysterious. And Anthony Burgess, for instance, who spent time in all these countries of the British Isles, said that the Welsh are the sexiest.
Sexiest?
Yeah.
I can vouch for this. My father used to work on markets in Oswestry, and I used to go with him when I was a young man, and I can vouch for Welsh young Welsh women. Of course, it may have changed, but at that time, I'm talking about, what would I be talking about, the late 50s. They were the sexiest. They were the sexiest women. But how does one account for that?
How does one account for any of these things? I don't know. It's
what would make Welsh women sexier than other women? I mean, what would it?
Maybe
there are some. Maybe there's some here. Who could...
But I mean, as with all these things, it's never one thing. And the answer that takes in the most possible influences and factors is the one that's likely to be right. But we all know that you end up with something like a national character. And can we call it Britishness when it's so various within Britain?
Well, that of course is an important point, but I think there's also a question to bring it up to a really contemporary discussion, in that the extent to which Britishness can really seem to be anything but a moving target. In 1975, sociologist Philip Jenkins published a book on Britishness, and he said, one of the key things about Britishness is the enduring character, which is a stiff upper lip, reticence, devotion to a sense of, and you know, you get the picture. It's very traditional. This was a sociological text. Now, do you think that, what do you think he would recognize were he still writing today at the prospect of having 20 primary school aged children cooped up by Channel 4 as thus the latest round in a whole series of extremely popular and extremely culturally powerful presentations of human suffering, misery, confessionalism, and all the rest of it? How can one say that British identity, if there is such a thing, has got anything to do in 2008 with what it was even in a textbook still quoted as in 1975? Have things been changing radically, and is that part of the problem that we're identifying tonight?
Tears is a very interesting one here. How come the British cry now all the time? We cry all the time. The sight of the country after Diana, you've mentioned Diana, was quite extraordinary. I mean, wherever you went for a while, I happened to be on the road travelling at that time, and I almost felt I was writing a travel book of England, on the demise of Diana. And wherever you went, there were people weeping. Now you see people weeping on television. If we are a country of stiff upper lip, where's it gone? We are now a nation of a trembling lip, a wet trembling lip. On television all the time, there are people sobbing about absolutely nothing. They're sobbing because they've just failed a talent competition, although they have no talent whatsoever, and how would ever anybody, but they're sobbing because they will, and they are made to sob. Presenters of television programs now, or panels, know how to make people cry. They make them cry by being rude to them, or they make them cry, but there's a simple thing. They say, what is your dream? Now, the word dream gets, that's another thing. Where's this word dream come from? The word dream didn't used to inhere in English life in this way. A dream meant a dream. When Caliban, you know, Caliban has his dream. It's a dream of something beautiful. He wants to fall asleep and dream again. Now, a dream, actually, we use the word dream to mean ambition. What is your dream? My dream is to be a very, very rich person, to win the X Factor, and to be a millionaire. That is my dream. So you say to them, well, I'm very sorry, you're knocked out, your dream's buggered, and they cry. So does this mean, I mean, is the dreaming and the crying an American import? Are we now dreaming and crying the way the Americans dreamt and cried? Have we been told to dream and cry, has television broken a dam that was there all along? Are we crying now for all the crying we didn't do in Shakespeare and Jane? Are we crying for our ancestors, or have we changed?
We're crying because we can't laugh.
Yeah, that's good. Good.
Perhaps we open it up. What do you think? Open it to them.
Do you want to sit a bit?
Okay.
We'll just take it one more round. Well, if we are doing that, I think there is still the question of change, and the question of changing identity to address, because it's certainly arguable the United States, I think you're quite right, Howard, to say that some of this is partly comes from America, from the influence of American society. Of course, the concept of the dream is very American. The United States has arguably changed a lot less in terms of its daily manners and daily outlook in 60 or 70 years. I mean, when, for example, I'm quoting it because it's so ridiculous, of course, you know, John Major tried to quote Orwell in the early 1990s in the Mansion House speech, and saying that England will still be in 50 years spinsters, the land of warm beer and spinsters cycling to Holy Communion through the morning mist. He was trying to recuperate precisely that which he was conscious was actually gone. But it has gone in a very short space of time. You know, when Larkin writes, "That'll be England gone. They'll be left. All the left will be concrete and tires." I mean, he's, of course, that was originally a commissioned poem, but he is putting his finger on something. A lot of middle class, and we're talking about the middle way, the middle class English people feel that the changes have been enormous. And the change of what represents, how their society and their manners are represented and what is normal has shifted beyond belief in 40 or 50 years. Do you agree with that?
Well, I've been writing about the sexual revolution, which, as we all know, took place in the 60s and 70s. And this was an absolutely enormous change. And in fact, I think it explains why the generational shift at that time was so sharp, that parents and children were at each other's throats during this time, particularly fathers and sons. All my male friends had terrible times with their father during this time. When they were coming, they're born after the war, they're coming to manhood just as the sexual revolution was taking place. And I think that was because, you know, number one in the revolutionary manifesto of the sexual revolution is there will be sex before marriage. No one had any doubt that that was coming, which must have been absolutely horrifying news for those for whom there had not been sex before marriage. And the fathers were left gazing around saying, you mean all that stuff about not having sex before marriage is just, you know, disappeared like leaves running down the street, twirling down the street. And so they'd call in their 18-year-old sons and give them a terrible bollocking, not about that, but about everything else they could think of. Then the revolution did take place, and I think it's still with us. I think it's, you know, the rise of women, and it's, we're still working. It turned out to be an incredibly complicated thing for women and for men. But now we're entering sexually, just to stay on the subject, we're entering a completely new era, in my view, and it's already with us, where children today learn about sex. Their sex education is not affected in a lot of sniggering when you dissect a worm in your biology class at the age of 11. Or in my case, by the way, there was no sexual tension between my father and me because he'd had that fight with his father. I remember my brother coming up to me when we were about 11, said, he said, quick, Mark, Dad's telling us the lot, he said. We already knew what the lot was, of course, but by telling us, he was sort of legitimizing it and saying, go ahead. But now what's happening is that sex education is pornography. And the whole repertoire of sex in the young is determined by pornography, which is, to define it, the industrialization of the idea that sex and emotion, and sex and reproduction certainly, have nothing whatever to do with each other. That always, people have always, as if people have always known, that you reproduce by sneezing, and that this sneezing in each other's direction, and this act of sex that peoples the world, has been drained of emotion and affect. So that, you know, I don't think anyone over 30 can really even begin to grasp what that will bring.
And it's hard to see where the comedy would come from in that. I can imagine, well, you're going to find it, but I can imagine that, you know, it could be quite savage satire. We are lucky in one way. I mean, this might be one of the reasons why we are comic writers, because we have, because that was sublimely funny to grow through the to have the 60s and the early 70s, which for me was when it was the 70s when the 60s really happened. It was late 1971 when the 60s actually happened. I was in Wales at the time, probably, so were you. But the sublime comedy of it. I remember when I would come home from school and I would say to my mother in the kitchen, there's a word, and she'd go, she'd put a hand out. Sometimes she'd actually put a hand over my face, stop. Don't speak. And she would pass me the dictionary. And the dictionary was always up. We always had a bookmark on a particular page, and it was underlined with a little red biro. We didn't have markers. In before the sexual revolution, we didn't have markers. There was a ball pen. And it was always open at the phrase intercourse. So whatever I asked
fell
for
open
meant intercourse. So we had a very strange sense of what intercourse was. I mean, almost every bodily function and every swear word I thought meant intercourse. This eroticized my life to an extraordinary degree very early on. But if they don't have this wonderful play between the generations now, what have they got? I mean, how is it coming to them? You know more. You're bringing a family up.
Yeah, but they're not going to tell you much. But I do have talked very frankly with my oldest daughter, who's married now, and she said that it's sort of ever present, this idea of what's expected of you, and it's determined by pornography. And you're dead right when you say there's no humor in that. I went to Los Angeles and wrote a long piece about the pornography industry, and it's a sort of anti-humor, the whole thing. One chuckle in the San Fernando Valley and the whole industry would evaporate. It's all very humorless people thinking they're being funny every now and then. If you want a really bad time, get a pornographic comedy, and you can see that they just don't have it. You know, they haven't got a sense of humor, and a sense of humor isn't an extra. As Clive James again said, people who haven't got senses of humor shouldn't be trusted with anything. You know, don't give them a letter and ask them to put it in. They can't do anything. They don't know what reality is, and they don't know what sanity is.
There's an instruction. Don't ask me how I know this, but I know this. You can buy, if you decide you want to write erotic novels for women, and Black Lace is one of the companies, you can write away to Black Lace and they will give you instructions on how to write an erotic novel, various degrees of heat or coldness, but they're all erotic novels. But the one instruction obtains no matter what kind of erotic novel, level of erotic novel you want to write for Black Lace, and that is never ever make a joke. Never ever make a joke, because if you make a joke, the erotic trance is blown away.
Well, on that note, I think perhaps we should end the erotic trance and move to a sense of humor with some questions from the floor. Can I just ask anyone who asks the question, the stewards are, I think, coming round with microphones, to remember to hand back the microphone once you've asked the question, because they've only got two microphones, okay? Anyone in the hall want to ask a question from our speakers in the front row? We're just waiting for the microphone. I think probably speak up a bit. Is that live? No.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Right. Thank you very much for all your comments about humour, because it strikes me that we live in an extraordinary age at the moment where satire, humour is definitely needed. Listening to Radio 4 coming along today, whatever your particular take is on the gentleman that's been sent back to, is it Holland? It's whether we're talking about Englishness or whatever, I think as writers now, if you think of the absolute absurdity of what's happening in the world, in our own country, credit crunch or any of these things, it's, I don't think, without being rude, we can be, I think this is the real time to be harsh in terms of criticizing society, using humor to do that, and using satire to do that. I just wondered whether you feel passionately about humor and the importance of humor at this particular time.
Well, it's been a long time coming. De Tocqueville, writing about American democracy in the middle of the 19th century, said, it's an amazing thing, American democracy. You know, it's an incredible thing with these great strengths and virtues. He said, but it's clear as day what its fate will be, a kind of flabbiness and a kind of mutual wariness, a stupor of mutual reassurance, and that is where democracy will lead. And sure enough, I think it's completely unstoppable. I don't think you can suddenly have, stringent satire in our culture. It dies. And I think the only thing, I said this some time ago, the only thing that could turn it around would be you don't welcome it, would be a war or an enormous crash. So you know, the virtues of multiculturalism are really polite fictions. The pretense that we're all alike, not only polite, uninteresting fiction. Of course, we represent, you know, millions of things are marching around inside us. Ethoses and beliefs that half understood. It's all still there. But the force of democracy, and I expect it to weaken with this crash because these polite fictions will be seen as luxuries that come from a prosperous time, and that when things are harsher, humor gets harsher.
There is a terrible assumption around at the moment, a monstrous assumption, that people have a right not to be offended. At heart, it has something civilized in it. We should respect one another. I actually don't think you can, in the end, live satisfactorily with everybody respecting one another because we are sitting upon too much. We need disrespect. Where we have the disrespect is the issue, really. I understand that we can't have disrespect in the streets. You can't walk onto a bus and abuse everybody on the bus, which is why I think the one good sign in our society is that we have comedians. We probably overvalue some comedians, but we do need comedians, and we need art. Art and comedians are inhabit a particular kind of space. When I was doing sociologist talk, I forget the phrase now, but there's a word for it. Thank you very much. Transitional space, where you can go, anthropologists talk about it, where you can go and do things that you're not allowed to do in the normal world. When I was doing my Seriously Funny, which Murray mentioned, which was a book I wrote and a series I made about comedy, I discovered that, you know, all communities have their own versions of carnival. At a particular time, you were allowed to do outrageous things and make jokes. We have it ourselves. I went in the course of that to the South Pier in Blackpool to see Chubby Brown, who was an utterly disgusting, loathsome, repellent comedian, sexually disgusting. And people went there and they had the time of their lives. But it was on the end of a pier. It was at the end of the, we talk about the end of pier shows. Piers are so important. They are neither land nor sea. And we have to have spaces. How communities decide which that space is something else. But you have to have spaces where all the decencies are trashed. And I don't think you can live a decent life unless somewhere or other the whole idea of decency is being trashed, whether that's two or three times a year or every Saturday night on the pier. I used to come here. You once had Bernard Manning here. You could barely... My television career was ruined because I made a series, this series, in which I said that Bernard Manning... I didn't say I loved Bernard Manning, but people thought I must have done. I simply said Bernard Manning was doing something that seemed to be important to the people who went there. He wandered into the Embassy Club 10 minutes from here. It wasn't the end of the pier, but it could have been the end of the pier. It was like no other place. You didn't feel you were in Manchester. Here I know I'm in Manchester. I look around, I see Manchester people. There you didn't know where you were. You were in some other place. And some important vile, loathsome, repellent, misogynistic, anti-Semitic. He was, as soon as he saw me, he made anti-Jewish jokes. It all felt all right. It felt good. I felt actually cleansed to have Bernard Manning spew anti-Semitic filth at me. It felt good. And you don't live in a healthy society where that can't happen somewhere. And we are moving towards a society where it can't happen anywhere.
I know. Another question from the audience. That the lady there at the end of the row.
Hi, you talked a lot about some great British writers in your debate, and I was actually wondering, as a teacher of English literature, how do you feel that Charles Dickens actually fits into this notion of Britishness, and what effect, if any, he had on maybe changing this notion?
Sorry, but that was Charles Dickens and...
Changing the notion, Charles Dickens, what effect he had in changing the notion of Britishness, I think. Is that right?
Well, I mean, Dickens is an unusual case because he's been assured for a long time of his status as a great novelist, but it's constantly called into question whether he's a serious novelist. And, you know, recent work on him has tried to rope him back by various sophistical means into the social realist tradition, you know, whose queen is George Eliot and Jane Austen. But he won't go. He won't come into that. He belongs to a traditionally further down the echelon called the low mimetic. His modern equivalents are people like Chaplin, or melodrama. You know, sawing the heroine in half on the railway track. That's actually the world Dickens inhabits. And it's all myths and fairy tales and long journeys and sudden illnesses and revealed parents, and it's more a kind of emblematic, fabulous reality that he deals with. Then too, these days people are saying, you know, Dickens applauded the cannonballing of mutinous sepoys in 1857. Dickens said of female equality that it was a melancholy absurdity and they should never have the vote. These were his public views, massive contradictions. But then his senses were so acute when he went to America in 1870 and wrote the book American Notes. He had gone on and on about how you know, there were racial differences and racial superiorities and inferiorities. And he wrote beautifully about the difference between going from a free state to a slave state. And it's an electrifying passage where he says that even on the physiognomies of everyone you meet, you see a terrible coarsening in the slave states of the white people. That this is a sort of a monstrosity that has. And there was, you know, when he used his senses, he was as modern as anyone. He belongs to this tradition we've been mourning. All the energy in Dickens goes into the bad characters, the frumps, the pedants. His goodies are all interchangeable, and all his energy is with transgression.
Yes, the demoniacal characters in Dickens. Who's the one with a Q in the old curiosity shop who just
Quilp.
Won't die?
Quilp.
Yeah, I mean, Quilp is fantastic. Or, I'm going to ask you another question. What's he called? The criminal with the dog in Oliver Twist, who's now on a musical stage. What's he called? Those kind
Bill
of people.
Bill Sykes, yeah.
Yeah, Bill Sykes. He was a wonderful poet of something indomitable in the English, something you feel they're unkillable. The Q man, Quilp. I keep confusing him with a Q. There's a Q in Henry James. He's unkillable. You feel you'd have to, like, it's like watching a Punch and Judy show. You kind of bang them and bang them, and they won't die. And I think there is some quality like that in the English, that picture of the, you know, the spinsters cycling through the mists won't get. Some absolutely powerful, indomitable thing.
Bloody-minded.
Yes. But what you never know with somebody is, with the really great artists, I don't think you ever know whether they are rendering a country that they see or inventing it. I often feel with Dickens that actually Dickens created an England, and that for a while, still in some quarters, people are playing Dickens. I know some people who kind of, you know, affect being characters from Dickens. They aren't consciously doing it, but I think many of the English have since Dickens. I think it's dying out a bit now, but for a while, England tried to live up to the picture of itself that Dickens gave them. And I think that is, when we talk about how novels reflect Britishness or Englishness, one shouldn't forget that often, really, with good writers, reflection is not what's going on. They create. They create what they see. It's not they reinvent and give back to us an idea of who we are, which we then go out of our way to live up to. I certainly tried to be a Lorentzian man. I was a Lorentzian man when I was young. Wasn't a pretty sight, but I tried to be a Lorentzian man.
Just to say, there's the very minor hypocrite in Dickens, in Martin Chuzzlewit, who has a facial palsy. He's only on for about 5 pages, but completely unforgettable. And I think we're rather in this position now in Britain that he's a con man, and he has half his face is paralyzed. So when he's doing his cons, he turns the sort of solemn, dead side of his face to his mark, to the gullible, while the other half of his mouth gloats and snickers, and it's, as many Dickens beauties are, it's a personification of a cliche. This man is two-faced, and he gives it flesh. But I think we're all a bit in that position now, with our paralyzed face and our lively face.
Is there another question? Gentleman in the third row there.
I was just wondering if in Britain there's a lot of quite large socioeconomic division, what you might call class. And I think I was wondering whether you thought that was a defining feature of Britishness, or whether the Britishness we've been discussing applies to particular parts of those classes.
Well, I would say that I lived through, into my 20s, a class system that had nothing to do with money. I mean, it had to do with the age of the money. The illusion being that if you had old money, that is to say, if you obtained it by doing all your gouging and skanking and cheating a couple of centuries ago, then it was suddenly clean money. And people were twisted up with anxiety about whether to say toilet or lavatory or sofa or couch or sitting room or lounge. Lives quite poisoned by these considerations. And this, give the old bitch credit where it's due, but Mrs. Thatcher did, with all her Keiths and Normans in her cabinet, I could see the class system evaporating under her. Now it's a sort of money system, and resembling America, where you can actually, the means are there to declass yourself upwards. That you could be as rich as Croesus in 1970, and it wouldn't make you an ounce more socially acceptable. So that has really gone. It's changed.
Now we can say couch, but we can't say banker.
I think we have time. There's another question there at the end of this row.
Hi, thank you very much. Just a couple of points, really. It sounds like fixedness is something which has informed all of what you've said tonight. Professor Pittock, you were saying about this distinction between Britishness and Irishness in poetry, and it seemed to almost mirror a lot what the government's saying, is that Britishness is tied to citizenship. And that rather refutes the notion that Britishness has a cultural legacy outside of the United Kingdom. I'm thinking maybe in Australia, the poetry of Les Murray, the novels of David Malouf, which draw very heavily on Britishness to inform themselves. But I'm thinking more about both the main speakers tonight. You seem to have a sense in which there is a loss. You've talked about earlier on about Britain leads the world in decline, that there is some sense in which there's a loss of sanity, a loss of humor, or even that we're a nation that seems to weep at the drop of the hat, which is possibly true, unfortunately. But the question really is are you arguing for an essentialized Britishness based on past cultural practice, or for something else, something different? Because that wouldn't appear to be very clear in what you said tonight.
Well, I think Britain has to change. I don't think it has any choice. It has to become more of a, not a multicultural society necessarily, but a multiracial society. We have to plagiarize the American society, which is one of immigrants. A Pakistani in Boston can say, I am an American, and all he's doing is stating the obvious. A Pakistani in Bradford would not have the same assurance of saying, I am an Englishman, I'm a Brit. And they should. We have to up the status of what being an immigrant is in this country, and make it the norm. And there's no choice, because this is our future anyway.
the Englishness I've been talking about, and I think Martin has too, is locatable essentially in language. That's the essence of it all. Some of the other things have been peripheral. The Englishness that I am interested in, whether it's of now or whether it's gone, whether I'm nostalgic about it or not nostalgic about it, is a thing which inheres in language. Thinking about the Americans, I remember when Henry James went back in the early, or just after the First World War, I think, he went back to America. He hadn't been there for I don't know how long, not seriously been there. And he goes around the Lower East End and he hears the Jews. Suddenly there's a lot more Jews in New York than there were before. And he hears them. He talks about them as Israel. He calls it Israel, the tribe of Israel. He talks about them swarming, which isn't very nice, but I don't think he means harm by it. And he talks about hearing the language and thinking how, you know, how vitally he hears Yiddish and he hears a way of speaking. And he thinks this is not the consecrated English that he imagined that was spoken in these places when he was last in America. He calls the places he hears this language being spoken in the torture rooms of the idiom. And he said, whatever else, when I think what might happen in 50 years' time, America might be lively, America might be vitalistic, people might be writing books, but there will not be writing in the consecrated English. A very interesting thing happened. It was almost as if Jewish writers like Philip Roth and Saul Bellow read that and took up the challenge. And they didn't say, yes, we out of the torture rooms of the idiom, we will produce something extraordinarily idiomatic. They said, we will show you English written as well as you ever wrote it. Because if you like, we are marginal to this community, we will not stay marginal. We will dig to the very heart of that community, and linguistically and artistically, we will keep alive the thing that you thought was in danger, and we will do it better. And indeed, they did. They did. You will not find many better sentences being written now in English than by Philip Roth, and you would not have found many better sentences being written than when Saul Bellow was alive. What I like about what's happened there, as opposed to what's happened here, is that there is. We talk about the multiculturalism seems to imply that how lively it is on the margins. Isn't that wonderful what's happening on the margins? The margins are very interesting to a culture. You can't have margins unless you have a center. And when we believe that there is no center, no actual culture to which we contribute, a verbal, visual, aesthetic culture to which we contribute, we no longer have a culture. I, as someone that wanted to write Jewishly, I only want to write Jewishly and about Jewish things, Englishly. I don't want to be swallowed up by things English, as many people who don't think of themselves as only English or primary English feel. But simply to hover around the margin and simply to make your statements from the margin and not feel that you are contributing to some central culture, I think is disastrous for you at the margins and disastrous for the culture. And a culture loses its nerve when it doesn't believe it has its own center, that this is where the culture lives, artistically, in the language.
I think that's a very eloquent statement of the case on which to close, because we must draw proceedings to a close. Yes, I'm going to ask everybody just to stay in their seats, please, until the speakers have left the hall, because downstairs in the foyer there's a bookstall, and there'll also be a signing session with our authors tonight. Can I just say to people also that there are two forthcoming events at the Centre of New Writing I should draw your attention to. On Monday the 23rd of February, Monday the 23rd at 6:30 in the John Thor Studio Theatre, the novelist and poet Helen Dunmore and poet Peter Fallon will be speaking. And on the 2nd of March, again a Monday at the same time, there's the launch of the Research Institute for Cosmopolitan Cultures, with Jackie Kay and Joe Pemberton, and that also in the John Thor Studio Theatre. That neatly illuminates one of the kind of aspects we've been talking about this evening. So if I could ask you to remain in your seats, please, for a moment until the speakers have left the hall. Thank you very much. Let us thank both our speakers tonight.